We've been studying the history of the church for the last 2 months. We're in the third and fourth centuries. We've talked a lot about the Roman Empire. Today we're going to talk about some of the fall of the Roman Empire, some of its beginning dissolution, and some of the other world powers that began to take over after that. Last week, you remember who one of the central figures we talked about in the Roman Empire was that caused quite a shift in the opinion of Christians?
Constantine.
All right. And so what was so significant about him, Bob? What did he do or what did he...
Well, he kind of reversed the hate and everything against the Christians that put them in the Colosseum and all that. He kind of reversed that.
He did. Actually, he accepted Christ at the age of 40. The day before he died, he was baptized by a bishop in Ephesus. So, although he claimed to be a Christian all of his life, he waited up until the very end, the day before he died, to be baptized. Which brings up an interesting point. You know, do we have that happening today? People, Gibbons wrote of him that and in some of the other letters, particularly from Eusebius, who is a contemporary at the time, a historian, said that he intentionally put off his baptism because he knew that his sins would prevent him from entering heaven. So he wanted to wait till the very last moment so that he wouldn't have opportunity for further sins after his baptism to ensure his place in the presence of God after death. What are your thoughts about those folks that intentionally wait and wait and wait because they know that, you know, it's too hard to be a Christian. I'm afraid that I'm going to sin and not be able to make it. So I'll just put it off.
Pretty risky business, to say the least. We don't know when we're going to die.
I think a lot of that is a lack of knowledge of the Bible, because if you just read the scriptures, we know that Christ will be forgiven for our sins. When we do sin, that's the reason Christ died on the cross in the first place, to forgive sin. And if we're not going to sin, then why did Christ die?
Not to mention, why wouldn't you want a fruitful life your whole life? Why would you just want it in your last day?
Yeah. So as you can see, Constantine was more of a Christian for political purposes, for power. He intentionally put a lot of people in the Senate and in ruling positions of authority in the government in Rome up in authority because he wanted to surround himself by a lot of Christians. So as you can imagine, if you were an elder at a congregation and the emperor came to you and said, I'd like to make you the chief whatever over in Rome, don't you think that there'd be some temptation of letting that go to your head or power? Well, obviously so. And so there were a lot of men who took positions of leadership in the church for political reasons, for political gain, and for power. And you can see the amalgam that we have between the church and the state that began and grew rapidly once Constantine was the emperor. We talked a little bit about his decisive victory in 312 at Milvain Bridge, which was just outside of Rome, where he defeated Maximum, who was one of the last four generals of the Tetrarchy there, wiped him out and paraded his body after he exhumed it from the waters of the river there beside Rome and paraded it through town to prove his leadership. Now, he didn't live forever, but he did establish several places. We talked about a few of them. He did a lot of building, a lot of architectural things. He built the Church of the Holy Sepulchre down in Jerusalem to begin all this veneration of Christ and the apostles, which was way out of line. He built the old St. Peter's Basilica in the spot of the Vatican and bringing articles in from all those dead men that were just men. But then he dies, just like any other mortal man, and his son Constantius takes over. We talked a little bit, we ended last week at 350, and that was the beginning of Mass in the churches. Okay, and we'll, last question of recap here. What did we talk about? Where did that come from, that term Mass? So in the early Catholic Church, when the sermon was ended, the Pope or the preacher or the priest at that time, at the end of the sermon, before the Lord's table, he would say these words, "Et missa est," which means "you are dismissed." And this was the signal that all the people who were not baptized could depart as to not to interrupt the service. And then all of those other folks could partake of the Lord's table. Later that phrase was shortened to the et missa, to the Mass, and was applied to the Lord's Supper specifically. As we hear it used now most often in the Catholic Church, the term Mass just means the assembling of those Catholic individuals. Any comments or questions before we move into some new material this week? All right, 360, the celebration of Christmas. So this is an interesting one. So this may cause some interesting comments as well. We'll try to entertain a few of them. Initially, as I'm sure most of you are aware, Christmas was a pagan festival in honor of the sun god that was celebrated at the winter solstice on December the 25th. Like a lot of holidays that we observe in the United States and a lot of the Western world, it had its roots in pagan worship. And that pagan worship quickly infiltrated into the Roman Catholic worship as well. And so we see very similar holidays like Ash Wednesday, Good Friday, and Easter right along with Christmas. The word Christmas is derived from the term Christus Massae, meaning the Mass of Christ. And it wasn't celebrated until about the 4th century. So 360. Any comments or thoughts on Christmas in particular or any other religious holidays?
Did St. Nicholas, was he part of one of the saints of the Catholic Church or something?
I think later on he was one of those folks that was, I don't know if it was Germany or one of the other countries north of that, but I think you're right. There was a St. Nicholas in the church. I'm not sure if it was the Church of England or if it was the Roman Catholic Church under the Holy Empire at that time, where there was a gentleman that I think probably advanced it quite a bit. But that's quite a bit further down the line from what I know. I haven't studied it extensively. I think that this might be one of those things, whereas we made comments about visiting some of these archaeological or historical sites. If you haven't given thought to it, give thought to it. It deserves your conscience consideration about these things. Any other thoughts?
This is probably a good example of something we talked about last week, where the early apostate church used any means necessary to fling people indoors. And, it was taking something that they were familiar with and making it fit in sort of an inappropriate way, making it fit into the worship of Jesus and God. And, it sort of evolved. And, we need to be cautious about those kinds of things, too, that, the apostles, when they went and preached, they preached the gospel. That was their message. They didn't mix other things in so that the message was more palatable. They preached the gospel. That's what they preached. And so we got to be careful we don't fall into that same trap today.
Now, the early church had nothing, no celebrations or anything like that with Christ's birth. The only celebration that we had is of Christ's death in the Lord's table. Like I said, that didn't come about till 360. Ted?
I guess this is kind of similar to what Dan was saying, but it's interesting that things have never really changed. I mean, even today we have similar things going on where the church, there are people that proclaim the name of Christ in an effort to break down barriers or do whatever they can to coexist with alternative beliefs and alternative lifestyles. You know, back then in the fourth century, the effort was, well, you know, we can make some of this pagan stuff a part of Christianity, and then that's what happened. And in my opinion, something similar that's going on today is on the subject of evolution, where, you know, obviously the Bible is completely opposed to the current teachings on Darwinian evolution, but somehow Christians have found a way of making that a part of their belief system. So same thing goes on now, where people sort of twist the teaching of the gospel to make it fit whatever the current trends are.
Thank you. The next thing I've got on the list is 360. There was a new emperor that came into play. His name was Julian. And Julian has also got the name by many historians as Julian the Apostate. He was the last non-Christian emperor of Rome. And many people believe that he favored the Jews and some of their worship as well. He wanted to revive the old Roman Empire and the polytheism that was a part of it. So he tried many things to get rid of Christianity. He didn't actively martyr and kill a lot of Christians, but he tried to reinvoke other religions at the time and not just Christianity, and kind of debase what Constantine had set up. While preparing, at this time, the Persians were growing as a world empire, and he needed to go to battle against them because they were coming in on the eastern territory around Syria in Damascus. And so he led a bunch of his armies toward that direction and made a stop in Jerusalem and met with several of the Jewish leaders at the time and inquired, why aren't you guys sacrificing animals and shedding blood like you used to in your old covenant? What do you think that the Jewish leader's response was as to why they did not sacrifice animals anymore? Where would they do it? They didn't have a temple, right? They lost the temple in 70 AD, so they had no place to acceptably worship their God at the time. And so his thought was, well, let's build a new temple. I'll give you the money, I'll give you the resources. And he actually set out an edict that the Jews, in conjunction with the Romans, would rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. This was in 361. How do you think that went? Okay, why do we know that God wasn't going to allow the temple to be rebuilt?
Because the temple had no significance anymore.
Okay. What about, I think of Christ's words in terms too. What did Christ say about the temple before his death? Not stone would be left on top of another that would not be thrown down. Many believe that that's a historic prophecy that would say that the temple would never be rebuilt. There's some interesting historical accounts of the men that took out to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. There's a man named Ammianus Marcellinus, who was a Roman historian that was writing at the time, and this is what he wrote. And although he weighed every possible variety of events with anxious thoughts and pushed on with burning zeal at many preparations for his campaign, yet turning his activity to every part and eager to extend the memory of his reign by great works, he planned at vast cost to restore the once splendid temple at Jerusalem, which after many mortal combats during the siege of Vespasian and later Titus, he barely had stormed. He had entrusted the speedy performance of this work to Alypius of Antioch, who had been the vice prefect of Britain. But though this Alypius pushed the work on with vigor, aided by the governor of the province, terrifying balls of flame kept bursting forth near the foundations of the temple and made the place inaccessible to the workmen, some of whom were burned to death. And since in this way the element persistently rebelled them, the enterprise halted. His story also records a pretty significant earthquake at that same year that the temple was attempted to be rebuilt. So as you can see, there's a lot of people that are saying, well, this is divine intervention. We've got these lightning balls, this lightning coming from heaven, striking these men as they're trying to rebuild the foundations. We've got this earthquake and all these things. You know, we have no idea exactly what was going on at that time. It's not exactly pertinent, but it's some interesting history about the attempted rebuilding of the Jerusalem temple.
If God allowed the temple to be rebuilt, that would signify that the Jews should live the way they used to live under the old law. That's done away with 2,000 years ago. And God's not going to allow that to happen because His temple is, we are the temple of God. It's a living thing.
Well, I've got a question then. I'm not aware of all this history and stuff. What do the Jews do now in Israel? Do they
go to the Wailing Wall and stand there. That's the only thing they got left.
Just a wall that was left.
Well, the Wailing Wall is the closest that the Jews can get to the old temple in Jerusalem because it's not held. It's held by the Muslims right now, and it's the closest that they can get to the temple. And so that's the place that they've chosen to worship, and it's the last remnants of the original wall.
And it's not even the temple; it was part of the courtyard.
Yeah, but it's as close as they can get today.
Well, I was thinking that one of the Romans rebuilt the temple.
Herod rebuilt the temple.
Yeah. So, does that tore down?
Yeah.
Okay. That was the temple that was lost.
That was the one in 70, okay. Correct?
And then it never was. Nothing.
Okay. So since that time, the Jewish religion, they have never practiced the sacrifice of animals like they did.
Not that I'm aware of.
That's the question. How can you go ahead and claim that you're following what your forefathers followed and not do what they did?
Yeah.
The Jewish religion has become what the Christian religion was when it was apostate. They were both perverted. Just like the true church was perverted and became the Catholic Church, Jewish religion, they had no temple, they gave up their animal sacrifice, they gave up all kinds of things. That religion became perverted, and so did Christianity, except for the true church, the true believers that continued to do what the apostles brought them.
I wonder what the Jews do then to cleanse themselves every year. I would think, because they probably still believe they live in sin, correct? Because they're waiting for the Christ.
They still observe, sort of, the Passover and observe the Day of Atonement. They observe a lot of those festivals, but of course, there's no sacrifices, there's no scapegoat, there's no anything.
They just keep certain things. They eat.
Yeah, they pick and choose what they want to serve. I remember in college we had a religion class, and we went over and visited the temple. I think it's out by Rogersville or Marshall. I can't really remember. And all that stuff over there. And it was recently in the news as well. And they've got a new age version of the old Jewish traditions. But it looks nothing like what we read in the Bible of the old Jewish practices of worship. Just like much of Christendom today does not practice the way that the first century church practiced. Both of them have diverged. 426, we're going to jump ahead a little bit. So we've got about a 100-year gap in there between Julian and this next individual, and there's other empires starting to rise up. There's the Turks that are coming about. The Muslims are going to show up on the stage pretty soon, and other world empires are starting to grow, and the pagan influence is starting to come back. And so we have a bishop out of Egypt, in particular, he was from Hippo, named Augustine, who wrote a book. You may have heard of the book, The City of God. The full name was, I got it written down somewhere. I think it may have got cut off. I think it's The City of God and the Pagan, Against the Pagan Empire, the Pagan cities. But basically what Augustine was trying to document was that although the Catholic Church, as was then, was being eroded and being picked apart piece by piece by the pagan nations, that even if they were wiped out, there would still be a spiritual city of Rome and a spiritual faith in the Roman Catholic faith in existence. And so he called that the City of God. He was a man who also believed and promulgated the doctrine of original sin and made contributions to a just war theory that basically stated that our active goal is not to pursue war and military efforts to overcome other nations and force Christianity on them, but if it's a matter of our interest and we have to protect ourselves, then yes, we will use force, and there is such thing as a just war. That was some of his beliefs as a writer at the time. I didn't have a whole lot on him because I didn't want to get too bogged down.
Okay, I won't bog you down too much. But I was going to say, he's kind of considered the restorationist in the Catholic Christian movement. He was trying to bring back the ancient order of things.
And he was.
We're 300 years down, or almost, from the time the church was established. And we know it already had fallen away in so many places, but he was trying to bring it back. But then he led it. He's got a lot of books. This is not the only book
Correct.
He wrote. He's got a lot of books. And he's really kind of the father of Calvinism. Now, it's not called. Of course, we get the name Calvinism from John Calvin several hundred years on down. But Calvin really went back and studied Augustine's writings, and that's where he got.
He had a lot of concepts in his writing about being saved through grace and original sin in his writing that I think Calvin did adopt. Many of the Catholics believe that his book, The City of God, is second only to the Bible. They believe that much in it. Okay, a couple hundred years later, 600 was the next big one. This is the rise of Islam. So Muhammad was a man from Mecca. He was basically a peasant boy who was a farmer and became a tradesman as well, and was from Mecca and tried to unify Arabia into a single religious organization under Islam. He is believed to be a prophet of God, along with other individuals like Abraham, Moses, and Jesus. So they believe in Christ, but they believe him to be a prophet instead of the Messiah. Born about 570 CE, and Tad talked a little bit about this earlier, was an orphan brought up under his paternal uncle, Abu Talib, and was a merchant. At the age of 40, he had a vision said to be from Gabriel and received his first revelation from God. 3 years after this, he started preaching these revelations publicly, proclaiming that God is one, which we get that term Allah, one God, and preaching complete surrender to the Lord. Muhammad gained very few followers early on and had a lot of resistance from the Meccan tribes, and so he went and waged battle against them. And we actually came out victorious, although he was outnumbered significantly. He made his pilgrimages and his travels, and shortly after his death and his final pilgrimage, most of the peninsula down there had adopted his teachings and were, in fact, united in one common religion of Islam. We're going to get to that a little bit later, but their empire started to grow pretty rapidly. So if you were looking at a map, and we have the Mediterranean Sea out here, and let's say that we've got Italy sticking down, Jerusalem on this side, we've got Egypt down here, Saudi Arabia, the peninsula. So they began in the peninsula here, and they spread up in this direction, and he picked up influences from Christianity as well as his some of the pagan beliefs from Damascus and Syria in this area, and he brought those back into part of his worship, and that's why he's kind of incorporated God a little bit into his religion. But shortly after his death, they began to spread. Some of their biggest spread was through the northern part of Africa. They came across down at the end at the Strait of Gibraltar and moved their way up into Spain. And they took over the lower part of Spain. And they were pressing up to France. So you have Spain at the bottom getting ready to join with Africa. And then just north of Spain, we have France. So in 732, the Islamic nation pressed through northern Africa and were working their way up into France and Gaul. And they were stopped by a very able general by the name of Charles Martel, who you may have read about. Charles Martel was a German man who, in Brumbach's book, I think the term that he used, or in somebody's, I don't know if it was his or not, preserved part of the Christian civilization at the time. And this was at a significant battle at Tours, France, which is right in the middle of France in 732. After he stopped the Muslims from invading into France, he went to Rome and he was crowned the king. And he got a nickname called Martellus because he was able to stop the infidels, as they often call them. And so his nickname was the Hammer, Charles Martel the Hammer. He was the grandfather of Charlemagne. And here's a quote from Gibbons on Martel. He was the hero of the age, and Gerard describes him as being the champion of the cross against the crescent. What do you think that means? Okay. So, I'm sure you've seen this symbol here. Where all have you seen that symbol?
Well, that's a symbol that people would equate a cross to Christianity. People equate that symbol to Islam.
Okay, it is it's part of the flag of the Nation of Islam. It's in the flag of Algeria. It's in the flag of Pakistan. It's in the flag of Turkey. It's in about 15 different nations' flags. Because a lot of them have their roots and their founding in the Islamic belief. But it even goes back a little bit further. So this wasn't really first used until the 17th century, this image here. But there's some historical documents that go back even farther than that. So we've got the crescent, which represents the moon god. And I found it really interesting. Anybody know what the moon god was called? Sin is the moon god. And then the star is a representative of Venus. And so some people, based on some coins and some hieroglyphs and inscriptions, are trying to date this representation all the way back to the Moabites. Remember who Moab was? One of two sons of Lot. So Abraham chose to stay on the western side of the Jordan, and Lot chose to cast his tent in the plains on the other side of the river. So we're talking all this land over here where Lot decided to go. We have one of his sons, Moab, that developed a nation here, and that spread all throughout. And they developed their own type of religion and worship, and they were all brought together in the 600s under Muhammad and his preaching and teaching. Correct.
After Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed, there were no more.
There were incestuous relationships.
And they were evil, wicked people.
So not only did we see some of these images in Moab, but we also see them in old Babylonian and Sumerian coinage. If you even look as far west as India, if you look at were to see a picture of the top of the Taj Mahal, it's got a huge dome at the top. And at the very top on the spear is the upside-down crescent and the star right above it. And you see that a lot on Ottoman architecture as well.
area.
Yeah.
Isn't it true that most of this area that the Muslims conquered at the time remain Muslim today?
Yeah.
And I believe it's true that many of the churches that Paul would have helped to establish and been a part of, the early churches, are a part of this area too. I mean, so a lot of the churches that we read about in the Bible, those areas are now Muslim.
In Asia Minor, Turkey, all of those areas right in there have been taken over and have not really turned back. That's all I had on Muhammad starting around 600. And after he died, his empire spreading and pressing against the Roman Catholic Empire and taking much of it. We find Augustine writing his book about this influence and trying to keep the church pure. They came across northern Africa up Gibraltar. They made it through Spain and took all of Spain and were stopped by Charles Martel at the Battle of Tours, which was in France. And so because of that, he was elevated and eventually became the king.
And some of these have biblical connections too in terms of Revelation and some of the prophecies of the Bible.
I'm going to let you teach on that one.
Yeah. There's biblical connection to what all you're talking about too.
Yeah. That's a very interesting part of trying to put history together with prophecy and biblical terms is really interesting and exciting to study it. So it's a great place. I've never really considered myself a history person, but once it started tying in with biblical things and Christianity, then it kind of became interesting to me. We've just got a few minutes. The last thing that I'm going to bring up is in 787, the Eucharist. So what's the Eucharist?
Well, it's a term used to describe the communion.
Okay.
So
Eucharist is a Greek word that means thanksgiving. And so you remember the words of Christ. When he had given thanks, he, you know, so on and so forth. Well, they took that to an extreme. That giving of thanks, they just attached it to the Greek word, the Eucharist, and took off from there. Galatius, writing in 492, said that this table was kept pretty simply the first 3 centuries after Christ. And then after that, there began to be some significant changes with the Lord's Supper. And one of them was the doctrine of transubstantiation. And if you recall that, that's the belief that once the bread and the juice have been blessed by the priest or the pope or whoever, whatever clergy is in charge at the time, that once it's blessed, it literally becomes the body and blood of Christ. So this man writing Galatius in 492 said that that was not true in the first 3 centuries, and that's not the way that things were done. And he was a Roman Catholic. And it wasn't until much later that this became part of their official worship. Next is a term that I'd not heard until I was studying this, intinction. Anybody heard of intinction? Okay, intinction is where they take the bread or the wafer and they partially dip it in the chalice that holds the grape juice or wine or whatever and give it to those people at the Mass. So there are several ways that the Catholics do that. Sometimes they can drink directly out of the chalice. Sometimes the priest has to dip it himself and give it to them. Nobody else is allowed to dip it in there. There's some funny rules. And I've just got one thing here as we close that I'll read about it and just kind of the absurdity of it all. Intinction. It's one of 4 ways approved by the Latin Rite of the Roman Catholic Church for administering Holy Communion under the form of wine as well as bread. The norms of the Roman Missal admit the principles that in cases where communion is administered under both kinds, the blood of the Lord may be received either by drinking from the chalice directly or by intinction or by means of a tube or a spoon. As regards the administering of communion to lay members of Christ's faithful, the bishops may exclude communion with the tube or the spoon where this is not the local custom, though the option of administering communion by intinction always remains. If this modality is employed, however, hosts host should be used, and the host is talking about the bread. Host should be used which are neither too thin nor too small, and the communicant shall receive the sacrament from the priest only on the tongue. The communicant must not be permitted to intinct the host to dip the bread himself in the chalice, nor receive the intincted host in the hand. As for the host to be used for the intinction, it should be made of valid matter, also consecrated. It is altogether forbidden to use unconsecrated bread or other matter. Intinction occurs in some old Catholic churches, and intinction is common in the Anglican churches, which often give the communicant the choice of drinking from the chalice or receiving by intinction. In many Presbyterian, Lutheran, Episcopal, and Methodist churches, the communicant, not the minister, dips the host in the chalice. This is the practice in some Baptist and Congregational churches as well, often using grape juice in the place of wine. Where is that in the Scripture? As simply as we've got is, he blessed it, he broke it, and he divided it to the apostles when he instituted it. And he said, this is cup, you know, is my blood of the new covenant. As oft you drink it, you do proclaim my death until I come. Things are getting way out of hand in the worship of the Lord, that are far removed from the early church that the apostles started and those faithful few partook in. Any comments before we close today?
I had a question about the Islam. Are they looking for a Messiah? In other words, they said Jesus is a prophet.
I don't believe so. They believe that Muhammad was the last prophet that was to come. So I don't believe that they're looking for him. And many of them that once they die, they go to paradise. So there was a term that was used by Charles Martel in going to battle. Actually, it wasn't Charles Martel. It was a little bit later on. And next week, we're going to talk about the Crusades. So this was the Catholic Church pressing back against the Turks and the Muslims in the Crusades. We'll talk about Peter the Hermit and Pope Urban, who said, as we're going to retake the Holy Land, Diet le Volt, which is, it is the will of God. And they went and executed and tried to force Christianity across the world. So we'll talk about the Crusades next week.